This is a CBS News special report from Washington, President Carter's fourth news conference. Here is CBS News correspondent Barry Serafin.
As usual, the auditorium of the old executive office building adjacent to the White House is jammed with reporters armed with questions for President Carter. We're told that President Carter today will have an opening statement before he takes questions. There's no indication what the subject of that statement might be. In addition to his news conference, Mr. Carter's schedule today includes a number of meetings, including one with former President Ford, who arrived in Washington about an hour and a half ago for his first visit to the Capitol since leaving office in January. Today's question and answer session is expected to run about half an hour. And here now is the President of the United States.
Hi, everybody. I have a brief opening statement to make about the function of the presidency and about Secretary of State's upcoming visit to the Soviet Union. I think one of the most impressive observations that I have understood so far about the presidency and what it stands for is a need to derive its strength directly from the people. There have been some expressions of concern about my bringing on these news conferences and in other ways issues that affect foreign policy directly to the people of our country. I think it's very important that the strength of the presidency itself be recognized as deriving from the people of this nation. And I think it's good for us, even in very complex matters, when the outcome of negotiations might still be in doubt, to let the members of Congress and the people of this country know what is going on and some of the options to be pursued, some of the consequences of success, some of the consequences of failure. I think in many areas of the world now, we are trying to invest a great deal of time and attention in the good offices of our country to bring about a resolution of differences and to prevent potential conflict. Tomorrow, the Secretary of State will depart for the Soviet Union. We've spent weeks in detailed study about the agenda that has been prepared. The agenda is one that's been derived by the Soviet Union and by our own country. I would say the central focal point will be arms limitations and actual reductions for a change. I've had long discussions with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and with other members of my own cabinet to derive our potential proposals, which Cy Vance will put forward to Mr. Brezhnev and the Russian leaders. We'll be talking about the limitation on arms sales. We are now the number one exporter or salesman of arms of all kinds. We have been working with our own allies to cut down this traffic, and we hope to get the Soviet Union to agree with us on constraint. We'll be dealing with mutual and balanced force reductions in the NATO area. And on this trip, Cy Vance will make a report on the attitude of the Soviet Union leaders concerning the European theater. We'll be trying to control the testing of nuclear devices, both weapons and peaceful nuclear devices, and we would like to eliminate these tests altogether, if the Soviets will agree. We're going to try to move toward demilitarizing the Indian Ocean, and here again, we'll be consulting closely with our allies and friends, and we're going to express our concern about the future of Africa, and ask the Soviet Union to join with us in removing from that troubled continent outside interference which might contribute to warfare in the countries involved. And we will start laying the groundwork for cooperation with the Soviet Union at the Geneva Conference, which we hope will take place concerning the Middle East. These matters are extremely complex. We don't know whether or not we'll be successful at all. but we go in good faith with high hopes. The Soviets have been very cooperative up to this point, and we are pleased with their attitude. And I know that the prayers of the American people would go with Cy Vance, our Secretary of State, to the Soviet Union in hopes that this trip might result in the alleviation of tension and the further guaranteeing of peace for our world in the future. Mr. Comey.
Mr. President, the pace of inflation has been picking up a bit, and at least temporarily, both the consumer and wholesale price indices annualized are in double-digit range. How do you see the outlook for inflation, and how are you coming and fashioning a comprehensive program to deal with it?
There's an underlying inflation rate of 5 to 6%, which is generally derived from the rate of increase in wages minus the productivity of workers. It's one of the best measurements. I think that the monthly reports that come in are quite often very misleading. They're transient in nature. We've had a drastic increase in energy costs during this winter period because of the unprecedented severity of the weather. And we've also had a very high increase in the cost of many food items, again because of damage to crops in different regions of the country and because of coffee losses overseas. My own guess is that the inflationary pressures will continue at about the level that they have historically in the last couple of years, around 6 or a little bit better percent. We are now preparing a very strong anti-inflation package, which will be delivered to the Congress and to the American people within the next couple of weeks. We've been working on it since even before I was inaugurated, and we've begun to exercise constraint on some of the spending policies of our own administration, and we also are beginning to assess the impact of many decisions made by government and the public that contribute to the inflationary pressures, which quite often are not obvious. And I hope to both learn myself and to let the Congress and the American people learn in the process how we can control inflation. I think the economic stimulus package that we have can boost the increase in our national product up to around 5% or a little bit better, which is crucial to cut down the unemployment rate. It will not be, in my opinion, a major factor in inflation, but on a long-range basis, I intend to help control inflation. I intend to cut down the expenditure of government programs well enough to bring about a balanced budget by 1981, and I'm deeply committed to this goal, and I believe that we will have unveiled for the nation to assess a comprehensive package against inflation within the next 2 weeks. Ms. Thomas?
And in terms of bringing the American people in on the dialogue, you spoke of arms reduction. Does that mean that Vance will take a new set of proposals on SALT? And two, you spoke of the cooperative attitude of the Soviets. Does that mean that you don't think that any of Brezhnev's statements in past week will have any bearing in terms of your human rights stand on the SALT negotiations?
Well, I think the first question is easily answered. Yes, we will take new proposals to the Soviet Union. We're not abandoning the agreements made in the Vladivostok Agreement. As you know, all previous SALT agreements have been, in effect, limitations that were so high that they were, in effect, just ground rules for intensified competition and a continued massive arms growth in nuclear weapons. We hope to bring not only limitations to continue in the past, but also actual substantial reductions if the Soviets will agree. That will be our first proposal. I spell this out briefly in my United Nations speech. And the second fallback position would be, in effect, to ratify Vladivostok and to wait until later to solve some of the most difficult and contentious issues. We hope that the Soviets will agree to the substantial reduction. The other part of your question was what, Tom?
It was in the question of this this cooperative attitude.
Well, I study Mr. Brezhnev's speeches in their entirety, and I think the speech made this past week to the General Trade Union Conference and one made previously at Tula, I consider them to be very constructive. There was a delineation in his speech between human rights, which he equates with intrusion into their own internal affairs, and I don't agree with that assessment. That's been divided in his speeches from the subject of peace and arms limitation, including nuclear arms. So I have nothing that I have heard directly or indirectly from Mr. Brezhnev that would indicate that he's not very eager to see a substantial progress made in arms limitations.
President, in your opening statement, you said you thought it was a good thing for you to speak out on negotiating details, but you didn't say why. As I understand the criticism, sir, it is that it impedes negotiations when you put out on the table just in a range of thought things that the parties haven't privately been able to work out. Why do you think it does not impede negotiations?
Well, I think if anyone would analyze the details of the statements that I've made so far, they're not so narrowly defined or specific that they would prevent both parties to a dispute from negotiating in good faith with a fairly clean slate ahead of them. The Middle East is one example. I think in many instances, the propositions that I have promulgated publicly are generally conceded to be very important and legitimate. But the public expression of those matters has not been made to the American people over a period of years. The exact means of defining borders in the Middle East, the exact resolution of the Palestinian problem, the definition of permanent peace, all these things obviously have to be decided between the Arab countries and Israel. But to point out that they are matters in dispute and that we hope they will be solved this year, I think is constructive. We have not intruded ourselves against the wishes of the interested nations in the Eastern Mediterranean. Both Turkey and Greece welcomed our emissary, and I think we can be a good mediator to the extent that both parties trust us to act in good faith. The same thing applies in Southern Africa, and the same thing applies to the MIA mission to Vietnam and Laos. And I believe that it's very important for the American people to know the framework within which discussions might take place, and to give me, through their own approval, strength as a party to some of the resolutions of disputes, and also to make sure that when I do speak, I don't speak with a hollow voice, but that the rest of the world knows that on my stand, for instance, on human rights, that I'm not just speaking as a lonely voice, but that I'm strongly supported by the Congress and the people of the country. This week, the Congress passed almost unanimously, I think with only two dissenting votes in both houses, a strong confirmation that my own stand expressed on human rights is indeed the stand of the American people. It's an unswerving commitment. It's one that will not be changing in the future, and I think for the rest of the world to know this, and for the American people to participate in that expression of concern about human rights is a very constructive thing.
You said that when you received the report from the Woodcock Commission that every hope you had for their mission had been realized.
Yes.
That report suggested that the best way to get an actual accounting of those still missing in Southeast Asia is for the normalization of relations. Yet your position in the past has been that there must be an accounting first before relations can be normalized. Have you changed your position, and what hope does that give for the families?
No, I haven't changed my position. I've always taken a position that when I'm convinced that the Vietnamese have done their best to account for the service personnel who are missing in action, at that point, I would favor normalization, the admission of Vietnam into the United Nations, and the resumption of trade and other relationships with the Vietnamese. I believe that the response of the Vietnamese leaders to the Woodcock Commission was very favorable. They not only gave us the bodies of 11 American servicemen, but they also promised to set up a Vietnamese bureaucracy to receive information that we have had about the date and the place that we think service people were lost, and to pursue those investigations. I think this is about all they can do. I don't have any way to prove that they have accounted for all those about whom they have information. But I think, so far as I can discern, they've acted in good faith. They've also suggested, and we have agreed, that we go to Paris to negotiate further without any preconditions. In the past, the Vietnamese have said that they would not negotiate with us nor give us additional information about the MIAs until we had agreed to pay reparations. They did not bring this up, which I thought was an act of reticence on their part. They had claimed previously that President Nixon had agreed to pay large sums of money to Vietnam because of damage done to our country. Our position had been that whether or not that agreement had been made, that the Vietnamese had violated that agreement by intruding beyond the demilitarized zone during the war. But they told Mr. Woodcock and sent word to me, we're not going to pursue past agreements and past disagreements. We're eager to look to the future. And I'm also eager to look to the future. If we are convinced as a result of the Paris negotiations and other actions on the part of the Vietnamese that they are acting in good faith, that they're trying to help us account for our MIAs, then I would aggressively move to admit Vietnam to the United Nations and also to normalize relationships with us.
Question, what about the families of the 2,500 people who have still not been accounted for, remains have not been returned?
I have nothing but sympathy for the families involved, and I can assure them through this news conference presentation that we will never cease attempting to account for those 2,500 American servicemen who were lost. I might point out that at the conclusion of the Korean War and the Second World War, of those who were lost in action, we only accounted for, I think we still did not account for 22%. At the conclusion of the Vietnam War, my understanding is that we'd accounted for all except about 4%. Now, I can't certify that we have all the information available, and we are never going to rest until we pursue information about those who are missing in action to the final conclusion. But I'll do the best I can, but I don't want to mislead anybody by giving hope about discovery of some additional information when I don't believe that the hope is justified.
Yes, sir. Mr. President, in the criticism of your water project hit list, so-called, which now totals about 30 projects, I believe,
sir.
There's been a suggestion that some kind of an environmental clique has produced that list, but there has been no actual review or consultation by some of the line agencies, Interior. Specifically, there's been a suggestion that Secretary Andrus has not been involved in the final consultations of the review. This after some years of review went into the production of those products or those projects themselves. Could you respond to that kind of criticism, sir?
Yes, sir. The so-called hit list is a list of projects that will be meticulously reviewed in public hearings where members of Congress, chambers of commerce, governors, farmers, environmentalists, and others who are concerned about each individual project can participate. All of the projects that have been recommended for reassessment have been carefully reviewed by Secretary Andrus in every one of those that relate to the Interior Department, the Bureau of Reclamation, and by the Corps of Engineers, those that are being proposed for construction by the Corps of Engineers. In effect, the Corps of Engineers and the Department of Interior have had a veto over projects that would be reassessed. With only two exceptions. One exception in Arkansas, one exception in Georgia, which I personally asked that they be reassessed when the Corps did not agree. But these projects need to be looked at very closely. I personally don't believe that any of the projects ought to be built, but I'll keep an open mind until after the complete review process is concluded, and will then make my own decision as far as the President's position is concerned. But I can assure you that the Corps of Engineers and Interior Department have been intimately involved in the preparation of the list and the reassessment of the list. It's a preliminary screening. Public hearings will conclude for me what my own position would be. Ed Bradley, then
Mr. President, on the subject of Vietnam,
yes, sir.
If you feel the United States is not obligated to uphold the terms of the Paris Peace Accords because of the North Vietnamese offensive that overthrew the South Vietnamese government, do you feel, on the other hand, any moral obligation to help rebuild that country?
I can't say what my position would be now on future economic relationships with Vietnam. I think that could only be concluded after we continue with negotiations to see what their attitude might be toward us. My own natural inclination is to have normal diplomatic relationships with all countries in the world. Sometimes there are obstacles. I believe that there are now 14 nations with whom we do not have diplomatic relationships. I don't know what the motivations of the Vietnamese might be. I think part of the motivation might be to be treated along with other nations in economic assistance from our country and in trade and development of their fairly substantial natural resources, including oil. Other considerations might be political in nature. They might very well want to balance their friendship with us with their friendship with the Soviet Union and not be completely dependent upon the Soviet Union. That's just a guess on my part. But I'm willing to negotiate in good faith. But as far as describing what our economic relationship might be with Vietnam in the future, after the relationships are established, I just couldn't do that now.
With that understanding and your hesitancy to disclose a position before negotiations start, beyond that, do you still feel that if that information on those American servicemen who are missing in action is forthcoming from the Vietnamese, that then this country has a moral obligation to help rebuild that country if that information is forthcoming?
Well, the destruction was mutual. You know, we went to Vietnam without any desire to capture territory or to impose American will on other people. We went there to defend the freedom of the South Vietnamese. And I don't feel that we ought to apologize or to castigate ourselves or to assume the status of culpability. Now, I'm willing to face the future without reference to the past. And that's what the Vietnamese leaders have proposed. And if in normalization of relationships there evolves trade, normal aid processes, then I would respond well. But I don't feel that we have that we owe a debt, nor that we should be forced to pay reparations at all. Yes, ma'am.
Yesterday, several congressmen accused your economic policies as being dictated by New York banks. Now, your plan for bailing out New York through using the IMF with a hyperinflationary process indeed does sound like a recent speech that David Rockefeller made in which he called for hyperinflating the advanced sector and imposing so-called command economies on the third world, which means massive austerity. Now, at the same time, over recent weeks, a number of our NATO allies... My question is, over recent weeks, a number of our NATO allies have indicated that they would rather see the problem of third world debt resolved through a debt moratorium. And I'm just wondering if there's any chance that you'd go along with our allies in that direction, or if you would insist on this kind of hyperinflationary bailout of Wall Street.
Well, I had no entreaties from David Rockefeller concerning the New York problem, nor have I had any of our allies that have called on me to join them in a debt moratorium. And I'm not in favor of a debt moratorium.
Would you mind telling us what our commitments are in Zaire and what the ramifications of those commitments might be to us?
We have no outstanding commitments in Zaire. Over a period of years, President Mobutu has been a friend of ours. We've enjoyed good relationships with Zaire. We have substantial commercial investments in that country. After the recent very disruptive conflict within Zaire, when the country was finally formed a number of years ago, it's been fairly stable since then. Zaire was involved, I think at least indirectly, in the Angolan conflict, and there are some remaining hard feelings between Angola and Zaire on that part. Some of the Katangans, who lived in the southern part of Zaire, are now involved in trying to go back into the area where they formerly lived. We have no hard evidence or any evidence as far as that that goes, that, that Cubans or Angolan troops have crossed the border into Zaire. We look on them as a friendly nation, and we have no obligations to them as far as military aid goes, but we have been cooperating and exchanging information with the Belgian government, the French government, and others just to try to stabilize the situation and to lessen the chance of expanding the conflict.
Mr. President, I don't ask this question in a churlish way or an argumentative way, but taking into recalling the unwillingness of the United States to intervene at the time of the Hungarian uprising, or at the time of Dubček's ouster in Czechoslovakia, what do you really think that you can accomplish for political dissidents in the Soviet Union, not in other parts of the world, but in the Soviet Union? And I have a follow-up I'd like to ask.
Why don't you ask your follow-up now, I'll try to answer.
Well, my follow-up is this. You are saying that all the evidence that you have from Mr. Brezhnev is that he is willing to go forward, or at least is receptive to SALT II negotiations.
Yes.
Mr. Brezhnev said before the Labor Congress that there could, that normal relations would be impossible, unthinkable was his word, if your human rights campaign continued. You have referred to private communications with Mr. Brezhnev, and I'd like to know in the follow-up question whether he has given you any assurances in those private communications that he is indeed willing to go forward on SALT II.
Well, it's not just a matter of private conversations. We're not trying to overthrow the Soviet government nor to intrude ourselves into their affairs in a military way. I think it has been a well-recognized international political principle that interference in a government is not a verbal thing. There's an ideological struggle that has been in progress for decades between the communist nations on the one hand and the democratic nations on the other. Mr. Brezhnev and his predecessors have never refrained from expressing their view when they disagreed with some aspect of social or political life in the free world. And I think we have a right to speak out openly when we have a concern about human rights wherever those abuses occur. And I think that Mr. Brezhnev has not said that he's concerned about my campaign on human rights. What he said is that he objects to any intrusion into the internal affairs of the Soviet Union. Now, I've tried to be reticent about it. I've tried to let my own position be clear in a speech at the United Nations and in my other actions. I've tried to make sure that the world knows that we're not singling out the Soviet Union for abuse or criticism. We're trying to move in our own country to open travel opportunities and to correct civil rights abuses and other abuses in our country. And so I don't think this is a matter that is connected with the search for peace through the SALT negotiations, for instance. The very fact that Mr. Brezhnev and his associates have welcomed Secretary Vance to the Soviet Union and have helped us prepare a very comprehensive agenda is adequate proof that he is not broken off relationships in any way, and that he has hopes that the talks will be productive. My belief is that he's acting in good faith. We're not going to negotiate in such a way that we leave ourselves vulnerable, but if the Soviet Union is willing to meet us halfway in searching for peace and disarmament, we'll meet them halfway. And I think that this is a good indication that they are acting in good faith. If we're disappointed, which is a possibility, then we'll try to modify our stance. Yes,
sir? On a topic on which I don't believe you've been questioned before, have you asked the Justice Department to finally come up with a national strategy for fighting organized crime?
I have discussed this with Attorney General Bell, and he has not yet evolved to present to me a comprehensive approach to the organized crime question. But I'd have to give you an answer to that after the press conference. I don't know what the status of his effort is, Mr. Spurlock.
A priority, or let's put it this way, how high a priority would you be giving to the fighting of organized crime?
I think quite high. When I was governor, we we organized a substantial effort to fight organized crime, and we detected the interrelationship between gambling, which a lot of people assume is just a normal part of life, prostitution, which some people think is not too bad, the distribution of drugs, which is condemned by almost everyone, and other forms of illegalities. And the upshot of our analysis was that they are very closely interrelated. Profits from gambling, profits from prostitution, and other more acceptable kinds of crime, in some people's minds, are directly used to enhance the distribution of heroin and other drugs. So I think it's a very serious problem. It's one that we ought to address from a national level. And one of the crucial elements that can be improved is to have local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies cooperate in a much more effective fashion in exchange of ideas and information and also in the prosecution of criminals.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much.
That winds up President Carter's news conference today. In case you tuned in late today, we can run through some of the highlights of this presidential news conference. Mr. Carter today defended his practice of speaking out on and spelling out administration positions on foreign policy. He noted that Secretary of State Vance will be leaving tomorrow for Moscow for preliminary talks with the Soviet leaders on arms. He said Mr. Vance will take proposals not only for limitations on arms, but also for arms reductions. Mr. Carter today rejected Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev's characterization of his expressions of concern about human rights as intrusions into Soviet internal affairs. He said that he believes Mr. Brezhnev still is hopeful on arms talks himself, and he called his own commitment to human rights unswerving. On other matters today, President Carter said inflationary pressures will continue to run about 6%, that he is preparing an anti-inflation program, which he hopes to unveil in about 2 weeks. President Carter said today that when he's convinced the Vietnamese have done their best to account for Americans still unaccounted for in Southeast Asia, he would favor normalization of relations with Vietnam, that he believes they have acted in good faith. He said they have not tied financial aid to negotiations scheduled in Paris. And he said he has nothing but sympathy for families of those Americans still unaccounted for, that he will never cease trying to get an accounting for them. On one other matter, he said, we have no evidence that Angolans or Cuban troops have entered Zaire. In Washington, I'm Barry Serafin, CBS News.